Like I said, I had a whole talk plan. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I was going to talk about, but I really want to share a retreat experience that I just went on, a two-week rich silent retreat up at Spirit Rock, which is kind of our main lineage holder for Western Buddhism, to Against the Stream and to Dharma Punks. It's where Noah was trained in his teacher practice. And I'm actually going to be trained there in the next few years, which is super exciting. Mm-hmm. Got an invitation to do that. They do a month-long retreat in February, a month-long retreat in March. And I have kids, so I only take about 2 weeks to go and sit the retreat. And while I was on this retreat, as often happens, like I was saying, in our practice, when we allow ourselves to get to a place of stillness, when we get past what we call these hindrances that are grasping us, either our restlessness or our busy mind or our very tired mind or the doubt that we should even be here doing our practice or these sort of desirous thoughts that there's something else I'd rather be doing tonight or I can't wait till dinner or, you know, these other ideas we might be having or maybe any aversions we're having to being here, to actually sitting. Once we can get through those, which are very natural, they're very typical, it's what happens. Once we can get through and past those, we reach this place of stillness and a place of honesty, maybe, a place of clarity, a place of truth. And when on retreat, oftentimes it can take a couple days to really slow down, to really arrive. You know, you've put your whole life on hold. You've often traveled. And getting to this place where first, usually people are very, very tired. So I actually spent the first day sleeping. And I allowed myself to do that because I knew I was tired and I knew that it would just kind of create a haze for the rest of my retreat if I didn't. So my first day I was very sleepy. And then the rest of the second day is usually just about getting through the minutiae of your head, all of our traps, all the places we get caught, all the things that maybe we don't allow ourselves to think about when we're out in our busy, typical day, but they get a chance in the stillness and the quiet of a retreat to rise up. And then we get through that, and like I said, this other place is reached. And sometimes it can be a little scary. Because I went into this retreat being very clear. Like I didn't have any heartaches or I didn't have any big things weighing on my mind. I went into the retreat pretty fresh. Nothing big going on. And I knew that could be an interesting place to be. Because I knew something was going to come up. Right, something was going to show itself that I hadn't allowed myself probably to look at because of my busy life, my day in and my day out, my kids, my work, all the things that I'm typically doing. Oftentimes we're squishing and pushing things down that can't be heard. So when we sit in some kind of stillness, they oftentimes come up to the surface. And so what came up for me was a little bit scary because it was a huge life decision that I wasn't really expecting. But it came and it was clear. And I ended up pulling myself out of a project that I was working on. And the big reason was because I'd completely decided that I want to spend and dedicate my time, my life, to the Buddha Dharma, to this practice in particular. I was kind of deviating out into some mindfulness and education stuff and some other very important things. It wasn't like a huge deviation. I wasn't like opening a winery or, you know, starting a clothing line or something. You know, it was just like, it was still very, very much vested in the world of mindfulness and a beautiful thing. But on that retreat, I decided that the Buddha Dharma, this particular practice, Buddhism in particular, was what my life's path really, really is committed to. And one of the reasons for that is because, thank you, is because these teachings are so profound and powerful. And they're not like that woo-woo part of myself that I told you about. That's not what this practice is. It's very pragmatic, it's very practical, and it's very helpful. And gives step-by-step processes into how to, the Buddha really did mean and hope for people to reach full liberation, to reach full and complete freedom. He wasn't a psychologist, you know, it wasn't about self-help for him. It wasn't about temporary or momentary relief. Although for sure, we get that. But his goal was full liberation, full and ultimate freedom. And I want to tell you a little bit about that time when the Buddha walked, because this is part of what's been so piqued for me, is culturally what was happening then, and how and why it's still effective and pertinent now, right? Like, how is it possible to almost 2,600 years ago, 500 BCE, 5th century BCE, the teachings that he brought to the world are still so pertinent. And he was, when the Buddha walked on the earth, it was a Brahmanic society. It was all about this sort of Atman, empty, no self teaching. And the teaching was reserved solely for the educated, the wealthy, and the male. And so this was the time that the Buddha came in. And I'm not going to go through his whole life and that whole thing, but what the Buddha was offering is he was offering this liberation to everybody. Nobody was excluded from his teachings. He believed that women could be liberated, and actually were in his lifetime. He believed that everyone from every caste system, the untouchables, everybody could be taught and learn what he was teaching. And so right before he died, many of his followers were very concerned. They were concerned that how would we hold on to these teachings? Once he was gone, what were they going to do? And so what the Buddha, in his brilliance, decided was that he was going to have these memorizing monastics. So his teachings were going to be put to memory. And so these different groups of monastics would sit around all day just in their practice, memorizing his teachings. And then what they would do is they would compare with each other, because they'd all memorize the same things. But they would compare with each other. They'd recite to each other. And if one word was wrong, they would reset, you know, because they wanted to get it exactly right. They didn't want to miss any of the teachings. And then, of course, he did die. And Ananda, who was his right-hand man for the last 25 years of his life, he then added many more teachings. He was said to have had a photographic memory. So once the Buddha died, Ananda added his memories of every precise word that the Buddha taught to what these memorizing monks had remembered. And the Buddha's teachings were an oral tradition for the next 300, some say the next 500 years. So nothing was ever written down. It was just an oral tradition. And I don't know how many of you have ever read any of the suttas or any of the Pali Canon, but it's very rote, and it's very repetitive, and there's a lot of lists, because lists are easy to remember. You have 8 of these, and 12 of these, and 5 of these, and 4 of these, and there's lots of lists, and lots of numbers, and lots of repetition. And that's why, is because this was all put to memory for so many years. And then 300 to 500 years later in Sri Lanka, it was actually written down on palm leaves, and that's what we know now as the Pali Canon, or the Vinaya also, which is the the monks and nuns pose. Those were written down on the palm leaves and have forever since been translated and commented on, and you know, all these traditions have branched off, and lots of different diaspora has happened. Lots has happened since the time of the Buddha. But one of the really pertinent things that I like to think about is the Buddha was really, really clear on the fact that he wanted his teachings to be in whatever the language was of the people that it was being taught to. So like I said, he didn't want it to be like the Brahmins, where only the wealthy or the educated could learn his teachings. So one of the things he said is, bhikkhus, the word of the enlightened one is not to be rendered into classical meter, meaning in Sanskrit, because that's what everything was taught in then. Whoever does so commits an offense of wrongdoing. I allow the enlightened one's words to be learnt in one's own language. So this was not an exclusive teaching. This was for everyone. And he focused much more on the meaning and the applicability of his teachings than on the academia of it, which is what it was before. So with this said, although they held on so tightly to his teachings and the precise words, he also compared his teachings to a raft. So he said, take my teachings, cross the river, use it for what you need it to be used for. But when you get to the other side, you don't take the raft and put it on your back and then walk across land with the raft. You can put the raft down. So with his teachings, you make the teachings your own. So these are now ours. These are now yours to hold and use as you need. And so this is where I'm going to deviate off. I really wanted to say that because I don't know, it just gives us it makes these teachings so palpable, you know? I mean, here they are in this room. The same ones. I mean, we really do try to be as precise in our lineage as possible with what we have. Obviously, things are going to change. Palm leaves. I mean, it's like, you know, it's kind of sketchy. But historians and academics and scholars and lots of people spend their whole lifetimes doing this stuff. And Anilayo, the guy I was talking about during the meditation with the breath, he actually wrote a book called the Satipatthana, which is he wrote a commentary on a sutta called the Satipatthana. Satipatthana is the four foundations of mindfulness, which is basically the basis for our meditation, for our mindfulness practice. But he is so brilliant because he, as his college dissertation, wrote this amazing commentary. So he's a very young man. He was only born in 1962. For those of you who appreciate that he was a young man born in 1962, he, since the translation of that, which I believe was in 2003, decided, I'm going to learn Chinese and Tibetan as well, right? So he, in 2 or 3 years, learned Chinese and Tibetan. And what he's done is he's taken all of these different translations and he lays them side by side and does this compare and contrast so that he can see precisely, oh, these two match, Chinese and Tibetan match, but the Pali Canon, a little off, so maybe this is right. Or he would take what was possible at that time, in the Buddha's time, this wouldn't have been possible, right? So let's move this over here. Anyway, point being that people are really giving it a shot to get it as accurate as possible, because this isn't just a faith-based practice in that way. It's not just like throw it to the wind and believe. It's a practice of put your ass to the cushion and do the work, you know? So, on this retreat, I did put my ass to the cushion. And I don't know how many of you have been on retreat, silent retreats. Okay, this is going to be a huge sales pitch for retreats because they're really amazing. I mean, when I went on my first retreat, I kind of swore off vacationing. You know, I kind of swore off holidays. I was like, what's the point of going to Jamaica or Rome or Nepal? No, I still like going to those places. But it was really kind of like, this was it. I had totally found everything I'd been looking for being on retreat. That other stuff was kind of a waste of time. And so I got my ass to the cushion. And what you do on retreat is you spend, literally, from the time you're woken up at 5 in the morning, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, you know, breaks for meals, sleeping, waking up, and doing it all over again. Which can sound and is redundant intentionally, but what it allows you to do, you don't wear a watch, you don't, you know, you kind of lose track of this sense of stability and holding and control and where I've got to be and emails and telephones and who I am and this whole sense of produced self that we create out in the world. You're being invited to just put that down, right? So I was invited to put it down, and I did. Like I said, I got through the 2.5 days or whatever. And then I found myself being a little bit lazy. And what you can easily do is procrastinate. If you're a procrastinator off of retreat, you can procrastinate on retreat. And all the things that you do off retreat, you do on retreat. You know, it's just the microcosm to the macrocosm. It's like a little petri dish, you know, and it's like this little way to see how we operate. And so I operate as a procrastinator many times in many things. So it's always like, oh, I have 2 full weeks. This is only day 3, you know. Oh, I have 2 full weeks. This is only day 4. Oh, I have 2. And then slowly, you know, the days are ticking by. And I'm like, but damn it, I'm a Dharma teacher. Like, I have to do this stuff. And I actually really like it. So I want to do this stuff. And so about 2.5 days in, I actually committed to the practice right after I arrived. And I have a particular fondness for walking meditation. I don't know how many of you have done walking meditation in this room, but it's, I never want to do it. I always try to avoid it. Yet when I do, it's always super, super powerful. And so what a walking meditation is, for those of you that don't know, is you pick a spot and you literally walk back and forth and back and forth, and that's all you do, walking back and forth. So the point is, it is your sitting practice in motion, right? So when we're sitting, we're used to our eyes closed, we're all in ourself, here we are. When our eyes are open and we're seeing things, all the sensory input starts to come in, other people, other things. So this is a way of bringing the practice, engaging the practice and bringing it into the world in a way. It's kind of like a transitionary helping point of the practice. And so you're hearing things, your eyes are open, you're walking, you're moving, but it's always coming back to each breath, always coming back to this footstep, always coming back to this moment. And so up at Spirit Rock is beautiful rolling hills and oak trees, and it was kind of cold, but I really wanted to take my shoes off, and I wanted to just find a bed of leaves and walk on the leaves and feel as close to the earth as I could, hoping that it would ground me a little bit. And so I did that, and I found these crunchy leaves by a creek, and there's the frogs, there's tons of frogs, and you can get into their conversations with each other, and it was just beautiful. And so, sorry, I'm getting sidetracked onto the beauty of it, which is good, it's all good, it's setting the scene for you guys. And so I'm walking, and the leaves are crunching continually. I don't know how many of you do this, but oftentimes when I'm in my breathing practice, maybe you could try this, I find it really helpful. I don't necessarily pick a spot, but it becomes like this circular motion, right? Of in and out, and in. And I just find this like, it just becomes sort of this very flowy in and out. And it's actually very nice, and I become very concentrated and still in it. And so I was doing that, and I found myself in this sort of circular motion of my breath. And in the stillness, And then I'd notice a thought arise. And I decided, I don't know how many of you were here last time I spoke, a couple months ago, but I was talking about feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So I decided I was going to do my feeling tone practice. So every time a thought arose, instead of going with the thought and getting caught up and becoming the thought, I was just going to call it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral can have grades too. It's not, you know, sometimes it's low grade unpleasant, like I stepped on a little rock or a, you know, a stick. So that was unpleasant. I would just call it as it was. As a pleasant thought would come through, I'm sure I thought about my kids 8 million times, I would just call it pleasant. Instead of being in the thought, I just called it what it is, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. And it became this motion, it became this rhythm. And when I got bored, I would have these sort of neither pleasant nor unpleasant thoughts. That was neutral, right? I would just notice neutral. So that's kind of like the what would be called the unwholesome neutral. The wholesome neutral I found was total freedom and liberation. It was actually this moment of nibbana, this cessation that we hear about as the third noble truth, right? First noble truth being that suffering exists. Second noble truth being that clinging is the cause to our suffering. And that it is possible to not have those. There is a cessation to this. There is a liberation from this. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. But that's not what this talk is about. It's about, I found that neutral, wholesome, so not bored neutral, neutral, wholesome, I was totally and completely free in that moment of greed, hatred, or delusion. If even for a second, right? Liberation can happen if even for a second for us. And then the hope is to sort of, you know, link a few seconds together and maybe get a minute and then maybe get a day and maybe get more. But then, you know, and I'd have that liberation and then I'd come back to, oh, right now I'm really hungry. So it moved into the physical realm. Most of my stuff was in the head. Then it moved into my belly. Okay, hungry. All it was a sensation in my belly that was unpleasant. That's it. Sensation, sorry. It says sensation a few times. Unpleasant. Typically for me, hunger means heavy unpleasant. It means discomfort. It means story in my head around when am I going to get my food? How could they make lunch at 12 o'clock instead of 11 o'clock? Because I'm hungry right now and it's 11 o'clock. What are they going to serve for lunch? You know, because this is all at the retreat center. And instead of getting caught up in what we call papancha, the mind, the proliferation of the mind telling the story about a mere unpleasant sensation that was happening in my body. So I'd just come back, unpleasant. And this really, if we look at it, is what our experiences are throughout our whole days. Your whole day is merely you're having pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences, either in your mind or your body. In our mind, it's through our perception, it's through our consciousness, it's through these feeling tones. It's through our thoughts, our volitions. But we're constantly, constantly, one step after the other, having input, feeling, and then we make a decision around that. And so what the practice of mindfulness is offering, the decision that the practice of mindfulness is offering, is to stay in that immediate, direct point of contact where we're feeling pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Not getting identified, not getting trapped, not getting caught. And so what I found, which was so beautiful and has just really carried with me, is that when I did that, when I stopped, when I allowed myself to go into the story, I'll use the hunger again, I became an angry, hungry, unhappy person. I am angry, unhappy person. I am. That's what I am. That's who I am. So I became identified. We become this thing, right? So when I didn't do that, when it was just unpleasant, I was just the observer of this unpleasant condition that was arising and passing. I was an observer of the pleasant condition that was arising and passing. And that's all that was happening. I didn't get caught. I didn't get stuck. And so I saw that point of freedom. I saw that lack of identification. And suddenly, what I noticed was a lot more, there was space for love. Suddenly, I was just feeling this warmth and love and generosity and kindness, because there was nothing to be mad at anymore. It was nobody's fault. It was nothing's fault that this was arising in me. It was just arising. And the same was true for the joyful, pleasant feelings. It wasn't my kids, or I have a student who said, he's in a new relationship right now, and he's like, I want her so much, I want to crush her to death. You know, it was like this thing where even what we think of as, you know, this desire, like we want to crush desire because we want it so bad. So whenever we're clinging, whenever we're wanting to push away or to hold on or grab or cling to something, there's no space for love. And that was something that I really saw. So when I saw these things just passing and arising just as they are for what they are, they could no longer hold on to me. And so that's what I wanted to share with you guys. And in that experience, I came across, like I said, the feeling tones, I came across the aggregates, I came across every time I suffered, I was then able to go, right now, I'm suffering. If I'm suffering, it means I'm clinging to something. If I'm suffering, it means I want something to be different than it is in this moment. Suffering, clinging, suffering, clinging. It's right there. So just an investigation for you in each moment. Just asking yourself, am I suffering in this moment? If I am, that means I'm clinging. Can I create space? So, for me, you know, I don't want to really call it anything, but I think I had an experience of what is called anatta. You know, this not identifying with a fixed or permanent self. A big teaching in this practice is that we want to identify with the body, which we know is changing, fleeting, ceasing, aging, dying. We want to identify with our mind. And when we can't do that anymore, we tend to suffer. And so this teaching of not self, the Buddha teaches that this is constantly, constantly, constantly changing. So don't bother holding on. So it's like holding on to a waterfall. Can't do it. So I'm going to end with, I hope you guys think this is a funny story. I read it to Papa upstairs and he only laughed once. But I thought it was really funny. It's short, so if it's not funny, you won't be tortured. But anyway, along with the teaching of this sort of like how we are off searching to find the self, like to find this self that, you know, in Buddhism it said there isn't one, or, you know, not a fixed and permanent one. Of course there's a self. Here we are, you know, we live our lives. But it's, anyway. Okay, so this is from The Onion, and I forgot my glasses. Darn it. I always do this. Do you guys know the onion?
Yes.
Okay. So, the longtime search for self conducted by area man Andrew Speth was called off this week, the 38-year-old said Monday. Speth sets out on a new life, moments after announcing the end of his search. I always thought that if I kept searching and exploring, I'd discover who I truly was. Well, I looked deep into the innermost recesses of my soul. I plumbed the depths of my subconscious. And you know what I found? An empty, windowless room the size of an aircraft hangar. From now on, if anybody needs me, I'll be sprawled out on this couch drinking black cherry soda and watching Law and Order like everybody else. Fuck it, he added. That, you say fuck in this room and everyone laughs. That's all it takes for this room. Seriously, we're trained. Beth said he began his search for himself in the late 70s, when in junior high he realized that there was more to life than what he could see from his parents' Dundee, Illinois home. The search initially showed great promise with Speth's early discovery of his uncle's old Doors records and a copy of The Catcher in the Rye. Over the next two decades, however, the leads just petered out. Although Speth searched in a wide variety of places, including the I Ching, a tantric sex manual, and a course in chakrology, he uncovered nothing. My family and friends kept telling me to give up, Speth said, but I couldn't believe that my true self was lost forever. Speth was dogged in his pursuit, sacrificing his higher education, bank account, social status, and personal esteem. Despite the rising costs and mounting adversity, he vowed he would never give up his search until now. I can't believe how many creative writing courses I've taken, how many expensive sessions with every conceivable type of therapist, Speth said. All that time, a whole life wasted on a wild goose chase. Since calling off the search, Speth has canceled his yoga classes, turned in his organic co-op membership card, and withdrawn plans to go to a sweat lodge retreat in Saskatchewan. On Tuesday afternoon, he loaded books by such diverse authors as Ludwig Wittgenstein, Meister Eckhart, and George Gurdjieff into a box labeled Free Shit, and left it outside of his apartment beside a trash can. That's where Pablo left, too. Speth tours Prague in 1991 at the height of his search. The only books I'll be reading from now on are ones that happen to catch my eye in the supermarket checkout line on the few occasions I leave my apartment to buy more Fig Newtons, Speth said. Speth said he will no longer lament his coding job at Eagle Client Services, but will rather embrace the fact that I have a job that makes enough money to pay for cable. Additionally, Speth has vowed to marry the first woman who will have me, whether I love her or not. Oh, and if I ever throw another goddamn clay pot in my life, it'll be too soon, he added. Though hardened and haggard from his long search, Speth expressed relief that it was over, asked if he had any advice for those who were continuing on their own searches. Speth had two words of advice: give up. Trust me, there's nothing out there for you to find, Speth said. You're wasting your life. The sooner you realize you have no self to discover, the sooner you can get on with what's truly important: celebrity magazines, snack foods, and internet porn. Poor Speth. So any questions? About your practice?
What was the name of the monk who was watching the people die?
Annihilo.
How do you spell that?
A-N-A-L-A-Y-O.
Annihilo.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah. Yeah, he said that changed his whole practice. As does, right? The importance shifts quite a bit, knowing that each breath we take is... Thank you.
Trying to understand the connection between compassion and ending your own suffering, because oftentimes ending your own suffering can seem to me like a lack of compassion for the things that are happening in your life. I don't know if you could help me sort that out. Because I feel like a lot of my suffering involves other people.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of clear my head and say it doesn't matter can feel sometimes like a lacking in compassion for other people or their conflicts or their suffering.
Right. So my understanding of it is that we're not saying that suffering doesn't exist. What we're actually doing is saying that it does. And we're actually completely acknowledging it. We're not trying to say it doesn't exist and that it's not there. It's actually the opposite. What is being proposed is that our relationship to that suffering changes, right? The first noble truth is that suffering exists and that it always will. We live on a planet, in a place with humans, it's just suffering is here. This is our reality. And this is actually what the Buddha points to, is once we can realize that, once we can know that, he actually says, until we really know our suffering, until we actually get intimate with it and know what suffering is, we can't find liberation from the suffering. So the point being to know it's there, to know it's real. And then what is our relationship? Like I said, what is our relationship to it? There's something called, that I like to talk about, called the second arrow, right? Like, so something happens to us. I didn't get any sleep last night, right? I have pets, they wake me up all the time, and I am a super grouchy person when I don't get sleep. I don't like it. So last night I got woken up about 3 or 4 times. All that was happening was I was being woken up out of my sleep. But for me, it causes a lot of suffering because my mind goes into this place, well, fuck, man, I'm teaching tomorrow night. I want to give a good talk. If I'm tired and grouchy, I'm not going to be in the mood. You know, my day is going to be screwed. I go into this whole secondary story about what's happening, when in reality, all that happened was I got woken up. Right? So oftentimes what we do is, here's the suffering, but we pile on so much more than is necessary. And so this is where, if we get into the whole other, you know, a whole other conversation and talk about how we get out of the suffering, and we're not talking about getting out of suffering, like it's not going to exist, we're in some utopia. I mean, apparently for enlightened beings, you know, maybe that's true. But we're still seeing the suffering of the world, of all humanity. And so where the compassion piece comes in is actually, what compassion is meeting suffering, meeting pain with love. So compassion is actually getting very close to that pain. It's not pretending it's not there. It's having a loving, open heart and meeting that pain. It's not about abandoning anybody or pretending. That we're not pretending that everything's okay. It's actually, like I said, the opposite. We're getting really close to and knowing intimately. And within that is where we find freedom. It's when we're trying to run and push away and cover up and delude, and that's where the actual pain is caused. And that's what we usually do.
So when you say suffering leads to clinging, how do you not cling?
It's clinging causes suffering.
Well, how do you not cling?
Right. That's what we're doing here. If we're learning not to cling. How do we not cling? Huge, huge bagged, you know. It's our natural tendency, right? Survival, we feel like we have to cling. See, so what I find really interesting about these teachings is, like I said at the very beginning, I don't know if you were in here, so you might have missed that brilliant thing I said at the beginning. Wait, what did I say at the beginning? Oh, yeah. Is that the Buddha really was aiming towards the highest liberation. His teachings were about that. Like I said, it wasn't about immediate gratification or self-help. His whole point, when he gained enlightenment, he actually didn't want to teach. He said, no way. They're not going to get it. They're too dense. They're too stuck. They're too trapped in their greed and their hatred and their delusion. How could I possibly explain to them what I just experienced? How could I possibly explain to them what enlightenment is like? I can't. They're not going to get it.
But what brought him to that experience?
Oh, I can recommend you to a few books, but okay. You know, having grown up a prince, having had everything, having had all of the desires and the wishes and everything, and then seeing that didn't give happiness, that wasn't lasting, it's fleeting. You know, you have sex one night, you need to have it again the next, or you have great clothes and then they wear thin and you need to buy some more, or you have a glass of booze and it, you know what I mean? It's like he found that he had to grab and keep grabbing. It didn't sustain. And then he went the whole opposite spectrum. He became a renunciate of the highest form, self-mortification, starving, almost dying, on this quest, on this search for liberation. And that didn't do it. Two extremes didn't work. So that led him to, okay, I got to find the way. I have to find what I'm looking for, and I know I will. And that's when he sat under the tree for 7 days, had this, I need to find out what happened in there, because honestly, I don't know. And I know it's in these suttas that I just haven't read yet. Everything that happened under the Bodhi tree came out, and his first teaching was about this middle path. Not going for the greed and the lust and all of that. Not going for total aversion and pushing away. Going for the middle of path. And so the story goes. Come back. This is your first day. You're getting greedy.
This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Anybody else? So we're going to end.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.